was forced to go back to the drawing board and rethink both the accounting and the restructuring of the firm. Once again, doing much of the math himself, he came up with a new scheme in which partners would exchange their shares of the profits on past investments for more equity in the new entity, the tricky swap he had tried to avoid originally. Ultimately, the firm used a formula based on the average multiple of its money it had earned on its investments historically. The arrangement was clear and fair enough that partners went along, and on May 21st, when the prospectus was next amended, it contained revamped financial statements. On page 83, the document mentioned in passing that Blackstone would not rely on the new accounting rules after all. That was a headache, but another problem brewing in Washington threatened to derail the IPO altogether. Private equity had long enjoyed two big tax advantages. First, its companies can deduct the interest on their debt, which gives them an advantage over companies that finance themselves with a higher portion of equity. Second, because most of the money that the partners in private equity firms make takes the form of carried interest, their 20% share of any investment gains, most of their income is taxed as capital gains. Instead of paying the top rate in the United States of 35% for high earners, buyout executives paid the 15% capital gains rate on most of their income. Similar rules apply in Britain, so that in both countries, private equity kingpins, as one British investment fund manager pointedly put it, pay lower tax rates than their cleaning ladies. On top of those long-standing tax traditions, Fortress and Blackstone were taking advantage of tax laws used originally for oil and gas and investment partnerships to avoid corporate taxes when they went public. Off and on over the previous year, various senators and congressmen had brought up the idea of altering the treatment of carried interest for private equity and hedge fund managers. The press was filled with stories of hedge fund gurus who made more than $1 billion in 2006, and Fortress had revealed during its IPO that its three founders, Wesley Edens, Peter Brigger Jr., and Michael Novogratz, and two other senior managers, had received $1.7 billion from their firm shortly before Fortress's IPO. The capital gains advantage was not unique to private equity or hedge funds. It stemmed from general principles of tax and partnership law and the gaping differential between the tax rates on ordinary income and capital gains. Carried interest, by definition, consists of investment profits, which are capital gains for tax purposes, and partnership law allows profits to be allocated to different classes of partners as the partnership chooses. In many family and other businesses organized as partnerships, for instance, managers receive a bigger share of the profits, whether ordinary income or capital gains, than the passive owner partners, regardless of whether the managers invested their own capital. The same thing is true of many real estate investment partnerships. Changing the law for private equity and hedge fund managers thus would have required creating an ad hoc law targeting them, or a much larger revamping of the tax code. Still, it seemed unfair. How could the richest of the rich pay tax at the lowest possible rate? Even former U.S. Treasury Secretary and former Goldman Sachs co-chairman Robert Rubin argued that carried interest was essentially compensation and should be taxed as ordinary income. From a political standpoint, too, raising taxes on a bunch of wealthy private equity and hedge fund managers was tempting because it would raise revenue and placate voters resentful of the huge profits being earned by financiers. The political situation for private equity was only exacerbated by a string of deals in the hospital and nursing home industries by KKR, Carlyle, and others. The Service Employees International Union, A feisty group that had been working to unionize that sector saw a chance to win concessions from the new owners by holding a political hammer over their heads, and it threw its support behind the tax reform effort. In May, SEIU officials charged before Congress that private equity treated employees badly and would put nursing home residents at risk. A few days later, the larger American Federation of Labor Congress of Industrial Organizations joined the anti-buyout chorus, dropping a 13-page letter on the SEC, arguing that Blackstone came under the Investment Company Act of 1940, which governs pure investment funds. Though the pressure tactics from unions were a powerful goad, the catalysts that spurred Congress to action were Schwarzman's birthday gala and the looming Blackstone IPO, say people who followed the congressional discussions. It was Steve's party, says Henry Silverman, because they were getting pressure from their constituents. Look at these fat cats, and look at the way they're living their lives. Senator Max Baucus, who was behind one of the proposals, had a particular antipathy toward Schwarzman, people on the industry side say. The political forces all converged the week of June 11th, just as Blackstone senior management was dispersing around the globe for the IPO roadshow to woo investors in person. As it happened, June 11th was the day that Blackstone finally revealed Schwarzman's pay, $398.3 million in 2006 alone. The figure was mind-boggling. It was nine times what Lloyd Blankfein, Schwarzman's counterpart at Goldman Sachs, made that year in cash and stock, though Goldman had 30 times as many employees and was universally acknowledged to be the most successful firm on Wall Street. Schwarzman's pay was twice what the top five executives at Goldman together took home. It attested to the profits private equity was churning out and revealed how rich Schwarzman had become owing to his nearly 30% stake in Blackstone. That by itself might not have fanned the political fires much more, but a front-page profile of Schwarzman in the Wall Street Journal 2 days later made him the poster child for the campaign to sock the new barons of finance. A cascade of headlines made the story an irresistible read. Buyout Mogul, How Blackstone's Chief Became $7 Billion Man. Schwarzman says he's worth every penny. $400 for stone crabs. And Schwarzman obliged the journal with quotes conforming to every stereotype of the financial shark. "I want war, not a series of skirmishes," he was quoted as saying. "I always think about what will kill off the other bidder. I didn't get to be successful by letting people hurt Blackstone or me." Nor was it just his competitors he treated mercilessly. The article implied that he was nasty to the help as well. Once, while sunning by the pool at his 11,000-square-foot home in Palm Beach, Florida, he complained to Jean-Pierre Zagat, his executive chef and estate manager, that an employee wasn't wearing the proper black shoes with his uniform, according to Mr. Zagat, who says he has great admiration for his boss. Mr. Schwarzman explains that he found the squeak of the rubber soles distracting. The journal portrayed him as a Marie Antoinette, nonchalantly spending hundreds of dollars on a casual lunch at his mansion. He expects lunches consisting of cold soup, a cold entree such as lobster salad or fresh grilled tuna on salad, followed by dessert, Mr. Zagat says. He eats the three-course meal within 15 minutes, the chef says. Mr. Zagat says he often spends $3,000 for a weekend of food for Mr. Schwarzman and his wife, including stone crabs that cost $400, or $40 per claw. Mr. Schwarzman says he had no idea how much the crabs cost. Like the fortune cover, the journal piece came out of the blue. The interviews had been conducted months earlier, before the IPO plans were disclosed, and Blackstone assumed the story was dead. Now, it surfaced at the worst possible moment. The next day, Thursday, June 14th, two senators, Baucus, a Democrat from Montana, and Charles Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, targeted the legal structures that Fortress and Blackstone were using to escape corporate taxes. Under their measure, any partnership that went public after January 1, 2007 would be taxed as a corporation. In practice, that meant Fortress and Blackstone, because the measure grandfathered in firms that had gone public earlier, and it quickly became known as the Blackstone tax. It would have taken a big bite out of Fortress's and Blackstone's profits, and Fortress's shares dropped more than 6% the following day. It was now open season on Blackstone and the rest of the buyout industry. The evening Baucus and Grassley announced their proposal, as James waited at Kennedy Airport in New York for an overnight flight to London for the next leg of the roadshow, Schwartzman caught up with him by phone. Should they call the whole thing off? To them, it seemed the entire world was lining up against the IPO. Drained from a week of numbing back-to-back, dawn-to-dusk presentations, the two pondered what to do. The firm's lobbyists were assuring them that no bill was likely to pass soon, so they decided to press on. They were in the home stretch now, just a week away from going public, but they would encounter ever more bizarre problems. Early Saturday morning, when James arrived in Kuwait for meetings, he was in pain. Those around him could see. He was whisked off to a hospital where tests confirmed he had a kidney stone. He was urged to stay in the hospital, but returned to lead the presentations in Kuwait and more later that day in Saudi Arabia. When the news got back to New York, the IPO team was alarmed. "I'm now going to speak to you like a mom," Ruth Porat told James when she tracked him down by phone at the hospital. "What are you doing going to road shows?" Schwartzman got into the act, calling David Blitzer in London. "Blitz, Tony won't admit this, but he's really sick," Schwartzman told him. "He'd shoot me for saying this, but you need to get on a plane right now." Blitzer caught the first flight out, arriving in Dubai in time to kick off the meetings scheduled there Sunday morning. No sooner were they underway than James walked in. "I did start a meeting or two without him, but he showed up straight from the hospital and just plugged his way straight through, as only Tony can do," says Blitzer. After one last day of meetings Monday, the exhausted troop boarded a chartered corporate jet for the return to London, only to confront one last alarming hiccup. An hour or so into the flight, the plane suddenly dropped sharply, enough to wake up the dozing passengers. A few minutes later, the pilot came back into the cabin. "I don't want to panic you," he began, and then went on to explain that the plane had lost an engine. In ordinary circumstances, the pilot said he would land at the nearest airport, but they were in Iranian airspace, and it was the middle of the night. He thought they could reach Athens on one engine, but he left it to James and Blitzer to decide what to do. They called Schwartzman and, after debating their choices, decided that it would be tempting fate for top executives of a pillar of American capitalism to make an unscheduled landing in Iran in the middle of the night. They told the pilot to try for Athens. They made it there in the wee hours, and after boarding a replacement plane that had been sent for them, they headed for London, touching down as the sun was coming up. There was just enough time for James to dash to an 8 a.m. meeting with investors at Claridge's, the posh Mayfair hotel that Blackstone had once owned. Back stateside, the political bombardment continued. On Wednesday, June 20th, Peter Welch, a Democratic congressman from Vermont, offered a bill to tax fund managers' carried interest as ordinary income, rather than as capital gains. The next day, as Blackstone and its banks were finalizing the price for its shares, two new congressional hand grenades were lobbed at them. Democratic Representatives Henry Waxman of California and Dennis Kucinich of Ohio wrote the SEC, asking it to halt the IPO, arguing that Blackstone's investments were too risky for ordinary investors. Meanwhile, in a letter to the Treasury Secretary, the Secretary of Homeland Security, and the Chairman of the SEC, Democratic Senator James Webb of Virginia demanded that the offering be postponed so that the government could investigate the national security implications of a foreign government taking a reported 40% stake in Blackstone. Never mind that it was a matter of public record that the Chinese were taking just a 9.9% non-voting stake. Every gun was pointed at us that week, trying to stop this thing, says John Gray, who was in Los Angeles that week for the roadshow and had to be briefed every morning on the latest bombshell from the Capitol. The SEC had already signed off on the prospectus, so the last-minute objections came to nothing. By Thursday, June 21st, the only thing that remained was to set the price. The banks had earlier estimated they could sell out the offering at $29 to $31 per unit. Around a table in Blackstone's boardroom that afternoon, James asked each of the Morgan Stanley and Citi bankers to write down on a piece of paper the price they would recommend, then reveal their numbers and explain their thinking. The Citi bankers each said $30. The Morgan Stanley bankers had written $31. Schwartzman asked if it might be better to price it at $30. He said he didn't want to be accused of taking every last dime if the stock later fell below the IPO price. But there was so much demand for the issue that the group finally agreed that they could easily sell out several times over at $31. And there was no reason to charge less. That evening, the banks bought the shares from Blackstone and sold them to their customers. The next day, when the new shareholders were free to trade their units on the New York Stock Exchange, the price soared to $38, as investors who hadn't been able to buy shares directly from the underwriters bid up the price. The price settled back to $35.06 by the end of the day. When the accounts were tallied up, Peterson walked away with $1.92 billion, and Schwartzman collected $684 million. James, who had been at Blackstone less than 5 years, pocketed $191 million. Tom Hill, Blackstone's vice chairman and manager of the hedge fund arm, got $22.9 million, and Mike Puglisi, the CFO, $13.8 million. The other 55 partners received $1.74 billion, or an average of almost $32 million each. The offering was not simply a breakthrough for private equity, but was the biggest IPO in the United States in 5 years, and it put Blackstone squarely in the top tier of Wall Street firms. Blackstone was now worth as much as Lehman Brothers, where Peterson and Schwartzman had launched their banking careers, and a third as much as Goldman Sachs. Blackstone had arrived. 11 days later, on July 3rd, KKR filed to go public, but Kravis's firm was too late. The very day that Blackstone units began trading, Bear Stearns announced that it would lend $3.2 billion to a hedge fund it managed that was facing margin calls as the value of its mortgage-backed securities tumbled, and the bank said it might have to bail out a second, larger fund. It was an omen. By mid-July, the credit markets were in full retreat, and it was hard to muster financing for big LBOs. The growing losses on mortgage securities were unnerving hedge funds and other investors, and buyout debt looked a little too similar, so banks could no longer raise money through CLOs to make buyout loans. Peterson and Schwartzman had closed Blackstone's first fund on the eve of the market crash of 1987. With the IPO, too, they had sneaked in just under the wire. Chapter 23. What goes up must come down. For 10 days after Blackstone's IPO, the buyout juggernaut rolled on, seemingly gaining speed. On June 30th, a new record was set when BCE Incorporated, Canada's biggest phone company, agreed to a $48.5 billion buyout led by the private equity arm of Ontario's teacher pension plan, edging out the $48 billion record KKR and TPG had set 4 months earlier with TXU, the Texas power company. Days later, on the eve of the July 4th holiday, after 10 months of off-and-on talks, John Gray finally cinched his deal to buy Hilton Hotels for $29 billion, Blackstone's second-largest LBO ever after EOP. At the end of that day, as people were filing out of their offices for the holiday, KKR at last filed its papers to go public. It was a spectacular finale, like the climax of a 4th of July fireworks, followed by silence. As the fallout from subprime mortgages spread that spring, the larger edifice of debt that had built up over years began to teeter. The floors were creaking, and cracks were emerging in the walls, and the markets were spooked. In early June, the spread on junk bonds, the difference between their interest rates and ultra-safe U.S. Treasury bonds, fell to its lowest level ever, below 2.5 percentage points, indicating that investors saw little risk in the debt. But then it abruptly switched directions. By mid-August, the spread was nearly 4.6 points, as demand for CLOs evaporated, and investors balked at buying debt of highly leveraged companies, particularly when there were few covenants on the loans, and bonds and the borrowers could opt to pay interest on bonds by issuing more paper. It was eerily familiar to veterans of the buyout world who had lived through 1989. Risk, which had been virtually banished from the financial lexicon, had returned to the discussion, and now the term credit crunch was being bandied about. There was no single event that triggered the shift, as there had been in 1989 when the collapse of the financing for the employee buyout of United Airlines sent the debt markets tumbling. But the pivot in 2007 was nearly as swift, and just as disastrous for private equity's investment banks as it had been in 1989. As underwriters and loan arrangers, the banks had issued legally binding promises to provide loans to finance dozens of still-to-be-completed LBOs, and had assumed the risk of peddling that debt to others. Until then, the buyout boom had been an absolute bonanza for the banks, generating hundreds of millions of dollars each year in investment banking fees. So long as investors were soaking up whatever CLOs the banks could offer, the banks could keep creating and selling those securities, funneling the money into buyout loans and bonds, and passing on the risk to outside investors. But suddenly, they couldn't sell them at the low interest rates everyone had expected. If a bank had agreed to float 7.5% bonds, and the market rate was now 10%, it would have to sell the bonds at a discount that would yield that higher amount. A $1,000 bond on which the company paid 7.5% would have to be discounted to $750, so the buyer would earn a 10% yield on its investment. With hundreds of billions of dollars in loan and bond commitments outstanding, selling them at a loss could wipe out years of bank profits. By late June, banks were begging private equity firms to make concessions that would make the debt easier to sell, so they wouldn't be saddled with billions of debt they hadn't bargained on holding. And unsold debt piled up, Interest rates spiked and new buyouts halted. The difference between 7.5% and 10% interest amounted to $25 million a year on every $1 billion of debt, which simply didn't compute in the finely tuned spreadsheets that underlay the deals. Pending deals, too, looked vulnerable. After 2 years of speculating about which big company would go private next, the financial world was now on death watch, as shareholders and traders bet on which buyouts would come unstuck. The first LBO to fall victim to the crunch was SLM Corporation, the student loan company better known as Sallie Mae, which alerted shareholders on July 11th that its $25 billion take private by two private equity firms, J.C. Flowers and Company and Friedman, Fleischer and Lowe, and two big banks, J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America, was in jeopardy. The buyers said they were worried about a reduction in federal loan subsidies, but it was widely suspected they had gotten cold feet because of the fact that Sallie Mae borrowed money constantly to buy loans from banks and other lenders and might not be able to do so at affordable interest rates. After SLM sued, J.P. Morgan Chase and B of A agreed to help refinance the company in lieu of the buyout, and the private equity firms dropped out. A few weeks after the SLM deal began to unravel, Home Depot Incorporated revealed that it was in talks with Bain Capital, Carlyle, and Clayton Dubilier, and would likely have to reduce the $10.3 billion price tag on its wholesale division, HD Supply, which the three sponsors had agreed to buy 2 months earlier because of slumping sales. At the end of August, the price was slashed to $8.8 billion. Bain Capital and Thomas H. Lee Partners' mammoth $25.5 billion Clear Channel deal was nearly scuppered too the next winter. Citi and Deutsche Bank, which had come up with an extra $1 billion of financing in the spring of 2007, so the buyers could increase their offer, later dragged their feet about supplying the money. After the company, Bain and Thomas H. Lee sued, everyone came back to the table. Clear Channel agreed to lower the buyout price, which reduced the debt needed, and the deal finally closed. In the renegotiations, the buyout equity firms managed to reduce their equity investment to $3 billion, so that in the end, the buyout was financed with a meager 13% of equity. Like many financial crises, this one began with a product that was at first benign, the subprime mortgage. There had long been niche players that offered mortgages to buyers with low incomes or poor credit histories, but over the course of the decade, mainstream banks and mortgage companies had moved onto this turf, envisaging millions of new customers. The mortgages paid high interest rates, and banks bundled them into newfangled securities that were then sliced and diced into multiple layers of equity and debt with different interest rates and risks. The most secure senior tier of debt had first dibs on income from the underlying mortgages and came with insurance in case there was a default, which ensured that they carried strong credit ratings. The whole was supposed to be safer than the sum of the parts, less likely to default than the underlying mortgages were. In fact, the entities that were created to hold the mortgages shouldered so much debt that many layers could be wiped out if things didn't play out precisely according to plan. The resulting mortgage securities, like the CLOs backed by corporate debt, were so seemingly safe and proved so popular with investors that money flooded into the mortgage companies. To drum up even more business and keep fees rolling in, lenders lowered credit standards so that even more borrowers qualified. Many banks and mortgage companies stopped bothering to verify the borrower's jobs or income, and they offered adjustable-rate mortgages with such low initial rates that even those with marginal incomes could afford to pay, at least for a while. Other home mortgages had negative amortizations. The buyer's monthly payments were less than the interest owed, so that the loan balance rose each month. The optimistic premise behind it all was that housing prices would continue rising, and the mortgages could be refinanced a few years later, or the home could be sold at a profit to pay off the loan. In 4 short years, the mortgage market was transformed. From 2001 to 2005, subprime lending leaped from 8% of all new home mortgages in the United States to 20%, and more than 80% of mortgages were securitized. It was a house of cards that kept rising until mid-2006, when housing prices crested and began gradually to fall. This coincided with step-ups in the interest rates on adjustable mortgages taken out a year or two earlier, which squeezed many homeowners. Meanwhile, thousands of buyers who had lied about their incomes or had never been asked simply stopped paying. By the end of 2006, 10% of all subprime loans were in default, throwing all the calculations behind the mortgage-backed securities askew. The defaults first cut into the lower layers, which had to absorb the first losses if defaults exceeded projections. But soon the default rates were so high that they threatened even senior tranches that had top credit ratings and were supposed to be insulated from mortgage defaults. In the cascade of unforeseen consequences, the jump in defaults in turn threatened to bring down the bond insurers that had sold protection on the senior layers, figuring there was a 1 in a million chance that the damage would ever penetrate that far. As each month went by, more mortgage companies failed, and several steps down the financial chain, more margin calls were issued to investors who had borrowed to buy mortgage-backed securities that were no longer worth enough to suffice as collateral for the loans. Eventually, the elaborately engineered mortgage securities that Wall Street had invented came home to roost, inflicting losses at the source, the banks. There was the collapse of the two Bear Stearns hedge funds the week of Blackstone's IPO in June. The same month, Germany's IKB Deutsche Industry Bank, which had invested heavily in American subprime securities, had to be bailed out. In Britain, which had seen its own subprime boom, there was a run on the giant British savings bank Northern Rock in September 2007, when it could not sell new debt to fund itself. As newspapers filled with photos of depositors lined up around the block at Northern Rock branches, waiting to retrieve their money, the British government finally stepped in. Until the spring of 2007, there had been a collective sense of denial about the mortgage problems and a persistent hope that they would not spread to other types of debt. But it was hard not to see the parallels to buyout lending, the escalating prices for companies, the extreme leverage, the loose lending terms, and the narrow margins for error. The securitization apparatus that had pumped up the mortgage market since 2004 had gassed up the LBO market as well. So it was no surprise when the banks, hedge funds, and other investors that were already choking on subprime losses recoiled at taking on more LBO debt. By the end of the summer, private equity firms, too, were getting skittish, and there was an epidemic of buyer's regret. Buyout firms and their banks, which by then were on the hook for more than $300 billion of LBO financing they couldn't sell, were squirming, looking for excuses to escape the deals they had struck. In some cases, like Home Depot's wholesale subsidiary, where the target's business dropped severely, there were legitimate legal grounds for calling things off or cutting the price. But many times the reasons looked like mere pretext, and the targets cried foul and sued to try to force the buyers to go through with the deals so that their shareholders would get the benefit of the generous offers. The companies generally lost in court because the takeover agreements had been drafted to make the buyers liable only for a fixed termination fee if they walked away, typically 2% or 3% of the deal value. Forking over hundreds of millions of dollars for nothing was a stiff penalty. That was the point. But it was better than being forced to pay a price that, as the economy and the markets headed south, now looked extravagant. In one notorious case, Apollo was pilloried when it tried to back out of a $10.8 billion agreement to buy Huntsman Corporation, a chemical company in Texas. Huntsman had already agreed to merge with another company when Hexion Specialty Chemicals, a company owned by Apollo, topped that offer in July 2007. Hexion's bid, orchestrated by Apollo, was almost 50% higher than Huntsman's share price just a few weeks earlier, before the first merger was announced. In the months that followed, as the price of oil, a key raw material, soared, and the economy began to slow, the offer looked like a dreadful miscalculation on Apollo's part, and Hexion sued to get out of the deal, arguing that the merged Hexion-Huntsman would be insolvent because it would carry so much new debt at a time when profits were falling. Huntsman countersued. Unfortunately for Apollo, Huntsman had negotiated a nearly airtight agreement, which specifically provided that the merger couldn't be called off because of industry-wide problems, and the judge who heard the dispute came down hard on the buyout firm. He ruled that Apollo and Hexion had deliberately breached the agreement, and that consequently the legal damages would not be limited to the $325 million breakup fee. Facing billions in potential liability, Apollo and Hexion paid $1 billion to Huntsman to settle the case. Credit Suisse and Deutsche Bank, which had sided with Apollo and Hexion, later chipped in another $1.7 billion to settle Huntsman's claims against them for trying to call off the deal. Blackstone aborted two of its deals, one to buy the mortgage arm of PHH Corporation, fell apart when the banks financing it said they would not lend as much as they had originally indicated. Blackstone coughed up the $50 million termination fee and walked away. It had a much harder time extricating itself from its $7.8 billion deal to buy Alliance Data Systems Corporation, a credit card transaction processor. The May 2007 deal, one of the few big LBOs Blackstone's buyout group signed up that year, was delayed by federal bank regulators, who were concerned that a highly leveraged Alliance would not be able to back up its bank subsidiary if the bank got in trouble. They demanded that Blackstone provide more than $600 million in financial guarantees to Alliance's bank operation in case that occurred. But because buyouts are structured legally so that neither the fund nor the private equity firm that manages it is liable for the portfolio company's debt, providing a guarantee was problematic. Blackstone eventually made an unusual offer to have its buyout fund issue a $100 million guarantee, but that didn't satisfy the regulators. When Blackstone pulled the plug on the buyout in April 2008, Alliance sued, charging that Blackstone hadn't lived up to its obligation to make its best effort to complete the deal. The case was thrown out in 2009. On the grounds that the buyout agreement didn't require Blackstone to provide any guarantees, and the firm got off without having to pay the breakup fee. Still, it was a costly episode. Blackstone had laid out $191 million to buy Alliance shares at $78 a share, while the offer was pending, and the stock then slumped. 3 years later, its investment was still underwater. In a coda for the age, the mother of all buyouts, that of the Canadian phone company BCE, was canceled in December 2008 after a year and a half of regulatory and financing delays. The company's auditors took the deal off life support when they said they might not be able to certify the company's solvency as required. That saved the buyers, the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, Providence Equity Partners, Madison Dearborn Partners, and Merrill Lynch's private equity fund, from what might have turned into the biggest private equity blunder ever. KKR and TPG were left holding the dubious record for history's biggest LBO, with TXU. Whatever the merits of the legal positions, the cancellations and the wrangling took a toll on private equity's reputation. For a decade, private equity had sold itself as the fast and sure solution for sellers. Buyout firms had been pitching themselves as solid corporate citizens, telling companies that it was easier to do business with them than a corporation, where decisions had to filter through committees and boards of directors and sometimes were subject to shareholder approval. They may have won in court when challenged, but the fact was that many of the industry's stars, Apollo, Bain, Blackstone, Carlyle, Cerberus, Clayton Dubilier, Fortress, Goldman Sachs Capital Partners, and KKR, had all bailed out of deals or cut their prices when the going got tough. Chapter 24. Paying the Piper. Market conditions worsened steadily as 2007 dragged on, and buyout firms breathed a sigh of relief every time they wiggled out of a deal. Most of the time, though, they couldn't undo the mistakes they had committed, or weren't yet persuaded that they had overpaid. But soon, the leverage that magnified returns when the markets were moving up began to work in reverse. The value of private equity-owned companies fell, but the debt on their books remained the same, a combination that threatened to pulverize billions of equity that buyout firms had plowed into their mega-deals. It was payback time for an industry that had gorged on the debt it was offered and flagrantly bid up companies, trying to grab as much as it could while the going was good. The dividend recaps that had yielded such quick, rich profits just a few years earlier caught up with some firms. Apollo had been particularly aggressive about ratcheting up the debt on its companies in order to pay itself dividends, milking a whopping $2 billion from 12 of its companies in late 2006 and 2007. Two of them, Noranda Aluminum Holding Corporation and Metals USA Holdings Corporation, saw their revenues collapse in 2008 and 2009 and ended up short of cash. Blackstone, too, had engineered two large dividend recapitalizations at the top of the market, a $1.1 billion payment from its travel reservations company, Travelport, after Travelport sold a big piece of Orbitz.com, its online travel website, in an IPO, and a $173 million payout from Health Markets, a health insurer catering to small businesses and the self-employed. Neither company sank under the added debt, and Travelport, in fact, held up well in a very difficult market. Private equity was in nowhere near as much trouble as the banking industry. Many banks, finance companies and corporations relied on short-term borrowing that had to be refinanced constantly. When the capital markets froze up, institutions such as Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch, even the giant Citigroup and the prestigious Morgan Stanley, faced insolvency when their debts came due, unless they could find new capital in some other form. By contrast, buyout firms themselves bear essentially no debt, and the financing for their portfolio companies, both the equity and the debt, was safely locked in for years. Furthermore, even the most extreme LBOs were modestly leveraged compared with investment banks, many of which by 2007 were geared 30 to 1. At that level, if the value of a bank's assets fell by even 1/30, just 3.3%, its capital was wiped out. Compounding matters, the banks were investing their own equity in leveraged investments, baroquely structured mortgage securities, real estate, and LBOs. It was leverage on leverage, which put their thin slivers of equity capital at extreme risk. Still, as shudders passed through the financial system in 2008 and the economy began to slow, problems accumulated for private equity. By the time Bain Capital and Thomas H. Lee Partners finally closed the Clear Channel buyout in July 2008, 2 years after trumping Blackstone's bid, advertising at the radio chain was evaporating. A year later, Clear Channel's revenue had fallen by almost a quarter. The company the buyers had labored so hard to acquire, like RJR Nabisco 20 years earlier, began to look like a clunker. Apollo, which had loaded up on cyclical businesses in 2006 and 2007, was hit particularly hard. In addition to the costly Hexion chemical debacle, where it lost its court battle to get out of buying Huntsman Corporation, the struggling housewares retailer, Linens and Things, went south on Apollo. The chain was such a shambles when it filed for bankruptcy that it was quickly liquidated. Across Apollo's portfolio, the results were dismal. At least five of its companies saw revenues plunge by 30% or more. They included Realology Incorporated, which licensed real estate brokerage brands such as Century 21, Coldwell Banker, and Sotheby's, and Realology's counterpart in Britain, Countrywide PLC. When housing prices fell and fewer homes were sold, both companies saw franchise fees tumble. Creditors took over Countrywide in 2009. Another Apollo casualty was Harrah's Entertainment, the casino operator it bought with TPG. Harrah's saw a similar fall-off in revenue, the first time in memory that gambling had declined during a recession. Blackstone's buyout and real estate funds also took small 2.5% stakes in Harrah's because the firm thought the casino industry was attractive and it had no other investments in the sector. In an earlier era, under covenants in the company's loans, creditors could have stepped in and taken control if the company's cash flows fell below specified levels. Not this time. The covenant-light loans for many of the big LBOs had so few restrictions that there was little bondholders or lenders could do until a company actually ran out of cash and stopped paying. Companies like Freescale and Clear Channel that had pay-in-kind debt had even more flexibility. They could choose to pay their creditors with more paper, as both eventually opted to do, escalating rather than paying down their debt. So long as a company didn't stop paying interest in some form, its day of reckoning would not arrive until 2011 to 2014, when its loans matured, giving its owners several years to turn things around. Blackstone's due dates were fairly typical. Its companies had virtually no debt maturing before 2013, but that year $34 billion was scheduled to come due and would have to be refinanced if the companies hadn't been sold by then. Even with that latitude, the crunch took its toll. Scores of companies went bust, wiping out their owners' investments. Cerberus, the vulture debt firm that morphed into a major private equity investor, suffered the most catastrophic and public losses. Cerberus led a consortium that bought 51% of General Motors finance arm GMAC in 2006, at a time when GMAC's mortgage lending operation was throwing off $1 billion in profits annually, much of it from subprime lending. Soon that business began to hemorrhage hundreds of millions and nearly brought down the whole company. Then auto sales collapsed. In 2009, GMAC took a government bailout that reduced Cerberus to a 15% voting position. Cerberus's buyout of the automaker Chrysler from its German parent in 2007 was even more disastrous. The investment had mystified most people in the financial and auto worlds, where the company's problems were seen as incurable. No one could understand how Cerberus thought it could turn around the smallest of U.S. automakers, or how it could make a profit on it. Even Cerberus's investors were kept in the dark. It refused to share financial information when it raised the $7 billion in equity for the deal, and told potential backers they would not receive regular financial reports, even after they invested. "It was a blind faith request. Trust us," says one investor who was approached but turned down the chance to join in. The same institutions that invested in buyout funds were demanding the opportunity to invest directly in companies alongside firms like Cerberus and Blackstone, because they then would not have to hand over 20% of the profits to the buyout firm as they would if they invested through a fund. With that enticement, Cerberus had no trouble rounding up the money. When Chrysler went into bankruptcy in 2009, Cerberus and its co-investors lost almost all their money. More established buyout firms had investments go down the drain, too. KKR lost Masonite, a building products maker, and Capmark Financial Group Incorporated, an $8.8 billion commercial real estate finance firm that it bought from General Motors with Goldman Sachs Private Equity Group, and Avios Fleet Maintenance, an aircraft maintenance company it owned, went under. KKR also had to invest more equity in a German auto repair chain, the mattress maker Sealy, and Kion, a forklift maker, to prop them up. Carlyle had 5 complete LBO wipeouts. Hawaiian Telecom Communications, that state's main phone company, which had had severe operational problems after Carlyle separated it from its former parent in 2005. Edscha AG, a German auto parts maker. Sem Group LP, an oil transport and storage company that had made bad bets trying to hedge the risk of oil prices. Wilcom Incorporated, a Japanese wireless phone operator that used a non-standard technology, and IMO Car Wash Group Limited, a British chain of car washes. TPG lost Alaris International Incorporated, an aluminum company it bought in late 2006, to bankruptcy, and suffered a $1.3 billion rub-out in Washington Mutual, a wobbly savings bank it tried to shore up. Thomas H. Lee Partners had a particularly poor track record. On top of its near-death experience with Clear Channel, 5 of its companies slipped into bankruptcy. An ethanol producer, an air conditioning equipment maker, a printing and advertising firm, an auto parts maker, and Simmons Bedding, the mattress maker that had gone through 5 successive LBOs. Forstmann Little, KKR's main rival in the 80s, which nearly vanished after it made 2 massive, disastrous investments in telecoms at the peak of the market a decade earlier, lost one of its last holdings, the radio chain Citadel Broadcasting Corporation, to bankruptcy in December 2009. In Britain, Terra Firma Capital Partners, one of that country's most high-profile buyout firms, was forced to tap its investors for more money to save its struggling recording company, EMI Group Limited, and sued Citigroup, which had financed the deal. In most cases, the companies lived on, taken over by their creditors or by new investors. Very few were shut down altogether, like Linens and Things, but in most cases the buyout owners lost all their money, and the lenders and bondholders often took a haircut as well in the restructuring. It wasn't just the portfolio companies that were in trouble. In Britain, there had long been a handful of publicly traded private equity vehicles, like KKR's Amsterdam Fund, that fed money into conventional LBO partnerships. That structure tripped up two of that country's oldest and largest private equity houses, Candover Investments and Permira, when the credit crisis hit. Rather than keep billions of cash on hand waiting for capital calls from Candover and Permira, the public funds had lines of credit they could use when they had to write a check for a new deal. The system broke down when the market tanked because the value of the feeder fund's assets, their stakes in the buyout funds, dropped, and they were receiving no cash back from the funds, so their credit was cut off. They thus could not meet capital calls when Candover and Permira issued them. The collapse throttled Candover, which was forced to sell some holdings and for a while considered winding down. Permira survived, but agreed to release all its investors from a portion of their capital calls to relieve pressure on the public fund. Its capital base shrank, and a key source of its funds was drained. The deals done in the heady days of 2006 and early 2007 inflicted enough harm to last for years, but a string of misgauged bailouts of financial services firms in late 2007 and 2008, made before the financial system bottomed out in early 2009, cost investors billions more. At the time, the turmoil looked to many firms like a terrific opportunity to buy on the cheap, and they leaped at the chance to shore up banks and other destabilized financial businesses. Warburg Pincus sank $800 million into a troubled bond insurer, MBIA Incorporated. Thomas H. Lee Partners and Goldman Sachs Capital Partners agreed to provide MoneyGram International with $1.2 billion after it took big losses on mortgage securities. J.C. Flowers and Company pumped $1.5 billion into Hypo Real Estate AG, a Munich bank that invested in American subprime mortgages. And TPG fronted $1.3 billion of a $7 billion bailout of the savings bank Washington Mutual. They were too early. When the crisis deepened, much of their bailout capital was lost. MBIA's stock slid from $31 to barely $2, and the MoneyGram deal had to be rejiggered when the company's assets deteriorated. The German government seized Hypo Real Estate, obliterating almost all of Flowers' investment. The rescue of Washington Mutual that TPG orchestrated was the most costly misjudgment of all. The $1.3 billion TPG invested in April 2008 was completely vaporized 5 months later when there was a run on the bank and regulators stepped in. It was an uncharacteristic misstep for the veteran turnaround investor, David Bonderman, who had made his name originally spearheading a bailout of one of Washington Mutual's predecessor banks in 1998, and who sat on Washington Mutual's board after it absorbed the other bank. Executives at two other private equity firms that sized up Washington Mutual thought it needed $25 billion or $30 billion of new capital to ride out the storm. They were right. With hindsight, TPG underestimated the risk that customers would pull their money out and overestimated the bank's ability to regain its footing. Even the investments that survived were in many cases now worth far less than what their owners had paid. The paper losses were alarming. One of Blackstone's co-investors in Freescale wrote its investment down 85% in 2008. KKR wrote off 90% of its chipmaker NXP and its German satellite TV company ProSiebenSat.1 Media. The dealmakers, who had fought fierce bidding wars 2 or 3 years earlier to snare companies, now faced the prospect of spending years laboring to keep them afloat and trying to devise a way to eke out even a small profit. It often was hard to see how they could, given the inflated prices they had paid and how steeply market